Welcome once again to the New York Jazz Workshop in Conversation With podcast series. I'm your host, CJ Shern, and I am here with a wonderful saxophonist. We're going to talk about his latest recording, A Life Between. I'm here with Chase Baird, who just got off the road with Antonio Sanchez and Migration, and it's been a long time since we've been putting this together. We talked about this back in June.
Exactly, at Antonio's CD release show.
Right. Yeah. And I'm glad we're finally here, able to talk about it and talk about your career. You were born in Seattle. You grew up in Salt Lake City. You picked up the tenor sax at the age of 10. And you were discovered and mentored by Michael Brecker in 2003. From 2007 to 2009, you attended California State University at Long Beach, and you later graduated from the Juilliard School in New York City, where you studied with Ron Blake, Steve Wilson, Joe Temperley, Frank Kimbrough, and Rodney Jones, all tremendous great players.
Absolutely.
And you have worked as a sideman with Mike Stern, Antonio Farrell, Tana Alexa, Christian McBride, and Chaka Khan, Jacob Dylan, and Diana DeGarmo. So that's an eclectic list, as you were saying before.
Exactly. A lot of different people from a lot of different places.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Salt Lake City scene and Alan Michael.
Sure. So as we were talking about a little while ago, I grew up mainly in Salt Lake City. I was born in Seattle, but left there when I was about 8 years old. So I got into music when I was a kid in Salt Lake. And one of my teachers, my main teacher at the time, was a gentleman named Alan Michael, who had formerly gone by the name of Alan Broffman. And he was from New York and had toured with Carla Bley in the late 70s and 80s, and he was a huge influence on me at that time and is still a very close friend. So I had access to some people growing up out there, but by and large, it wasn't the most musically fertile scene. But I think that sometimes situations like that can actually breed the opposite of it, in the sense that because I didn't have access to much of what I felt like in jazz, I ended up feeling a really strong desire to seek it out in what ways I could.
Was it the improvisational aspect, the rhythmic aspect, the harmonic aspect?
To me, it was the emotional aspect. In the sense that jazz just felt like something that I didn't have in my environment growing up. It was this, I don't know if you've ever been to Utah, but it's sort of an austere place, both culturally and in terms of the landscape. It's very beautiful, there isn't, to me, jazz was this really elegant, contemporary, but also very sensuous thing it was not something I'd encountered and was very drawn to when I first discovered it. So,
do you recall some of the first jazz that you heard growing up?
Yes, and my dad, I should say, he's a trumpet player, amateur trumpet player and musician. He was always really into jazz, among a lot of other types of music, but grew up listening to Brecker and Coltrane and Miles and Chick Corea and of course, he really loved Kenny Dorham and Blue Mitchell and Freddie Hubbard and trumpet players, because that was his bag, kind of. But I was always really drawn to things that were fairly sophisticated harmonically, or really colorful harmonically. Like one of the first solos I ever transcribed was Michael Brecker on Syzygy.
That is one of the greatest tunes.
Isn't that amazing?
Ever.
It took me probably 4 or 5 months to do it. I had to get like a slowdown software and figure it out, really. But I just was always really interested in that kind of playing, where it's like these sort of elemental blocks of color, very strong harmonic shifts. I would say that was early on, that was something I was really drawn to.
That tune, as a matter of fact, I bought that album over, I don't know how many years ago. I was still in college, and there was still a Virgin Megastore. And I spent about $200 that night. And
did you get the LP or the CD?
The CD. I got the CD of that, and I had also bought 8081 at the same time. And that tune, especially the duet at the beginning with Jack DeJohnette, is just like, it's just one of the most explosive things. And then that unison line with Brecker and the EWI.
Yeah, of course. Which James Farber was the recording engineer for this latest album I did, Life Between, because I had loved his work so much on those early Brecker albums. And I asked him about that, and he said, Mike, I can't remember whether he played it on Iwi or Tenor. He played it on one, and then he went back in the studio later, transcribed himself in real time, and then did it along to the record. So it said it took like several hours. I think it was a 4 or 5 hour process to get it done, you know. But, yeah.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, Pat Metheny's on the record. I thought Pat would do something like that because he's been known to do things that are pretty precise like that in the studio.
Sure.
And man, that's incredible. And actually, you had been discovered by Brecker and were mentored by him in 2003. So talk about how you met him.
I would say that's a generous way to put it. But I had gone to a master class with Jeff Hamilton when I was about 13 or 14 years old. And Jeff sort of made the point in the master class to say that really great musicians are more accessible than we generally think they are. And you should really take the initiative to reach out to people that you feel inspired by. And I kind of took it to heart, and I was telling my parents about that experience, and they helped me put together a letter and a CD of some things I'd recorded at a summer camp. And we sent it to Michael's manager, Daryl Pitt, at Depth of Field. And then Daryl forwarded it to Michael. And then Michael ended up getting in touch, and we got together when he was traveling through town. And it was pretty mind-blowing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's such a shame that he's gone. I still can't believe it because I had gotten seriously into his thing in high school because I had a mentor. He was the guitar and string teacher, a man by the name of Larry Lally in Johnson City, New York. And he was very, very into Brecker. And he was one of the gentlemen who were responsible for getting me out of my hard bop, narrow box. And I had spent time listening to records like Tales from the Hudson. And I had seen Brecker when I was 7 years old at the Hollywood Bowl. Mm. And for some reason, at that age, I knew what an iwi was.
Sure.
And the people behind my mom and I said, "How old is that kid?" Because they were like, "What? He's talking like a grown adult, you know?"
Yeah.
But, you know, Brecker's playing on his last record particularly
is astounding.
Is just, it's some of the most emotional playing. And a real highlight for me was being able to get that album signed by both Pat and Jack.
Mm.
And
nice.
It's just a record that I still listen to all the time. And one of the things that I've noticed about your playing was that you have that very, very soulful thing that both he possessed and also Coltrane possessed. Mm. And What's so fascinating about Brecker, before we get to the new record, is that he was in that generation with Dave Liebman and Steve Grossman,
of course,
where they were really
scene.
Exploring Coltrane's innovations, like the first
totally.
Generation. And I was talking to a gentleman the other day, and I said that he said to me, "Who's the best tenor saxophone player you've heard?" And I replied, "Michael Brecker," because I said he took the innovations of Coltrane so far, and you hear like so many players who have synthesized it. And then you know, you hear it in guys like Chris Potter too, yourself, you all have synthesized it in a unique way.
In various ways. Yeah.
And one of the things that I noticed too about Antonio's thing with Migration is, and he told me this in an interview too, he said that he likes to have that Brecker thing to some extent.
Of
in the
course.
Music.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely feel that in the band. I think a lot of times, especially in the writing, when the saxophone solo happens or when there's an iwi solo, there's a certain evocative climax in the music that is reminiscent of something Brecker would have done. You know, and I've thought that a couple of times. I'm like, man, I really wish I could hear Mike play on this. It would be so inspiring, you know?
Yeah, and when Antonio did the big band record, there was a saxophonist named Paul Heller on it. And there was a tune, I forget which tune, but I wrote the liner notes for that album. And when Heller's solo started, I literally got tears in my eyes because it was so much like Mike, like something that Mike would have played. And Vince Mendoza was the arranger, and Mike and Vince were very, very close.
Of course.
And it was just so, like, it was this intensely spiritual thing.
Of course. And
that happened.
It's super spiritual. I think that people easily get carried away with thinking of Mike as this incredible technician. He was a virtuoso. He was incredibly knowledgeable about music. I know he was always studying throughout his life various aspects of the music. But it, at the end of the day, it's just so evocative. It's just so emotional. When I remember seeing him as a kid a couple times. I mean, both that time I met him, but then also he'd come through Salt Lake a year before with his quartet with Tane and Eric Rivas and Joey Calderazzo. And I remember leaving the concert just feeling like electricity had just been coursing through my body for 2 hours. You know, it was just incredible.
Yeah.
And I think that there, you don't find that often. I think I've heard Potter do it, you know, also to an extent, but Mike really had this really, something really special, which.
Yeah. And Two Blocks from the Edge is like one of his greatest albums. All of them are great. And like,
it's so well produced.
Yeah.
Too. So that, you know, and that's something I think about when making an album is how to create an assemblage of tunes and with production and all of that flows in a way like one of Mike's. I mean, it's just, they're so well done.
Yeah. And with that, that's a great segue into your own career. On the first record, Cross Current, it was with a local group of San Francisco players, I believe.
No, actually. It was a couple players from New York and a couple from Los Angeles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
New York and Los Angeles.
And then I was living in Utah at the time. I was sort of in between school in Los Angeles and moving to New York, and had met a drummer there by the name of Steve Lyman, who's also from out there, but had spent some time in New York. So the two of us were from there, and then everyone else was from the coasts.
Yeah, and with that record, because I heard a little bit of it last night on streaming, you have a defined compositional identity even from that record. And it's been 10 years between Cross Current and A Life Between, but in between there, no pun intended, you did a record with Venture, which is Mark Sherman's group. Mark Sherman is a professor and teacher at the New York Jazz Workshop School of Music.
Exactly, and at Juilliard, which is where I knew him from.
Mm.
And I never studied with him directly, but that program is so small. I mean, there are 40 students in the entire program when I was there, so you really get to know, everyone gets to know everyone.
Yeah, so this record, you had said that you wanted A Life Between to sort of encapsulate everything that you like in music, and you want the listener to sort of have a particular experience. And the group that's on the record, the great Brad Meldow, Dan Kamilinski on the bass.
Shimolinski, yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course.
He also just goes by Chimmy because of the difficulty with the last name. He sort of has adopted a nickname, but
Chimmy.
Yeah, Chimmy.
Dan Chimolinski, yes.
Yep.
And Antonio Sanchez. The thing that's very unique about the record, I think, is that particular band, you all have grown up in a certain area of music
that
encapsulates the 80s, you know, the whole Seattle scene of the 90s, the quote-unquote so-called grunge movement, and that is definitely on the first track of the album right off.
Of course, yeah.
It's amazing how it goes between that heavy rock groove with Neer Felder, who I forgot to mention, his crunchy power chords, and it goes into these nice places, and Brad takes this incredible solo on the tune. Reactor is another tune, and Wait and See has that incredible duet at the beginning with you and Antonio, which was definitely shades of Mike and Jack.
Of course, and inspired by that syzygy kind of concept, or, you know, or Coltrane and Elvin. And
Yeah, that's something I picked up right away in the review that I wrote, is that particular, you know, area code.
Totally. It's a lot of fun doing that kind of thing with Antonio, especially because he's just so interactive.
Oh, yes.
You know, and we actually don't play that style a lot in Migration, so it was fun to do some things on this record I don't do with Antonio as much, you know.
Wow, yeah, you know, and you're right. He is one of the most interactive drummers. I mean, the most amazing thing about him is that he really listens to what everybody's doing, and he provides different backgrounds for each solo. And he's just so musical. It always blows my mind when I hear him. And I'm not saying that just because he's a close friend of mine, but because he's truly...
He's a master. He's without a doubt among the greatest living drummers. And I was a mega fan before joining Migration, and and still am. I mean, there's nights on stage, right? You know, Tana and I will stand kind of off to the side when the trio is doing their thing, and just kind of get to really take it in from that vantage point. And I'm still blown away.
Yeah,
you know, years into playing with him now, it's just amazing.
Because you joined in 2017, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I began subbing in the band in 2017.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So back to your record. So Brad Meldow is on the album, which is just fantastic. And my understanding is you met him in the park in a bike ride or something.
I'd met him a number of times over the years, but the first time that he would remember was actually the day I graduated from Juilliard. I had gone to have lunch with my family who was in town. We went to a place, a restaurant on the Upper West Side. Afterward, my sister wanted to go in a particular store. I didn't want to go in, so I was standing out front, and Brad rode his bike past me. And I literally ran after him in the middle of the street, chased him down a couple blocks, yelling, "Brad, Brad, Brad." And he's kind of looking over his shoulder, stops at this intersection and kind of confused. And we talked for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and then he went his way. And then the next week, he was playing at the Blue Note with Christian McBride, and I took him a manila envelope with a Cross Current and the lead sheets of what became Ripcord and A Life Between in that manila envelope, and asked him if he would check it out, and he said, "Sure, I'll do it sometime." And then I never heard from him, you know, for 6 months or so. And then,
that's the way it goes.
That's kind of the way it goes. And also I should add, with the help of Susan Brecker, who I came to know after Michael's passing, and she has and continues to be someone that's been very helpful to me in my career in New York. And I let her know that I had met Brad, and would she be willing to reach out to him on my behalf and let him know that I'm not a total hack. And so she did that, and even then she didn't get a response right away. I mean, he's so busy. So but finally, 6 or so months later, he wrote both of us back, and that sort of began the relationship, I'd say, formally. And then we would correspond, you know, every now and again. I transcribed some of his tunes, sent him the lead sheets. He would send me back the corrected versions. And at one point he was playing at the Village Vanguard, put me on the guest list. I went and hung out, and there was just sort of a 2 to 3 year process after that of sort of slowly getting to know him.
Yeah. And this record, it follows almost 10 years after Cross Current.
Mm-hmm.
So usually in that time, there is a period of artistic development. Like, I could think in terms of artists now, Ben Williams took a few years between State of Art and his most recent record, and then Tana, of course, with Ona coming out next year.
Sure.
And her first album, that's about a 4 or 5 year.
Yeah, I would think Ode to Heroes, probably, right?
Yeah. So what exactly was the reason for the 10-year gap between the albums?
When I made Cross Current, I sort of felt like there was a certain level of production achieved. There was a certain level of playing, but I realized that I was going to quickly get boxed into a certain thing, at least internally. I felt like I if I were to just keep doing that, touring that project, that I would get stuck there. And I wanted a lot more. And I hadn't lived in New York yet. I wanted to move here. I wanted to go to school. So I came here and did that. And especially in the first 3 or 4 years, there was just a lot of openness to experimentation with a lot of ways of playing I hadn't really considered before. I got, you know, very interested in free playing, trying to, you know, blend kind of more of a classical concept with the music. When I first moved to New York, I did, you know, played a little bit with Dan Tepfer and Joe Martin, and that was influential on me from the standpoint of a certain way of interacting and developing things. And so I really wanted to explore all those different concepts.
Yeah, because after the migration gig, I had mentioned how I heard the Brecker thing, and somebody on Facebook had said before the album came out that they heard an 80-81 type of intensity.
I remember you said that. That's really interesting. I would have never thought of that on that track, but that makes sense.
Yeah,
from that perspective.
Right. And you had said also to me that you said that your style was a combination of different things. So what you just mentioned with the sort of avenues that you wanted to combine between cross currents and a life between, is that sort of what you were talking about?
Yes. I mean, there was so much music that I explored in the last 8 years or so. You know, it was, and I think one of the reasons this album is sort of bizarrely eclectic is from that standpoint. It was just trying to explore these different things and then put it together in some kind of cohesive package. And then honestly, to help me formulate where I want to go next, because now that I made this, I have a sense of what I enjoyed the most on it and what inspires me kind of going forward. And I just needed to kind of see some things through to the end, you know?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
And the way Near plays on the album, especially on the title track, which is almost dreamy in a way, there's a point in the middle of the track where he's almost playing like these synth pad like harmonies, and there's some progressions going on, which are the type of thing that I absolutely love and go gaga for, you know. And that tune just has this thing, and Antonio is so sensitive with the cymbals.
Absolutely. That tune in particular, I wish I had the sheet music to show you, because I wrote that one very differently than you normally write a jazz tune. It's actually written out sort of like more like a Chopin nocturne or something, where there's no chord symbols. It's just a sheet. It's like a sheet. It's a piece of music with every note written out in terms of the voice leading. Okay. And I found there were different ways of doing it. If I wrote that tune out more like a conventional jazz tune, people played it very differently. All of a sudden I got more of an ECM kind of concept on it, but I really wanted something that sounded almost classical. Like I was listening to a lot of Mahler when I wrote that. I was really into Mahler 5, and I loved the Adagietto on that. Mm-hmm. And not that it sounds particularly like this, but there's a certain sense of the voice leading and the way the melodic architecture works that I wanted to capture. And I found it was the best way to do it was actually write it out in 4 or 5 part voice leading classical harmony, essentially.
Wow. I have the box set of Mahler's Complete Symphonies by the New York Philharmonic at home, and I'm going to have to dig back into that. And check out what you were talking
part
about.
Part 4. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
The Von Karajan recording, too, is really nice on that. Yeah.
The second symphony is just, oh.
I can't speak to it. I honestly haven't checked that one out as much. But
the Resurrection Symphony, it's very, it's deep. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
And really, also, too, on the last track of the album, In the Month of May, which is Debussy, I think.
It's Schumann.
Schumann, yeah, right, yeah. Schumann, yes. Brad Meldow plays that almost like it's his own tune.
Of course,
so
yeah, it's beautiful. You know, and that one, too, was funny, because I had the original Schumann score, and then I had kind of just done a condensed version of it into Sibelius, just if people wanted to not read all the, you know, the sort of frilly looking writing and stuff on the thing, and of course Brad opted to use that original score because he wanted to see that, to take in the atmosphere, the vibe of it, and to have the lyrics right there, and he plays so beautifully on it. I mean, Dan also, both those guys play solos on it. It's just really wonderful.
Yeah, and I also wanted to ask you too about your pop work. Mm. So Chaka Khan in particular, tell me about that.
That was actually just one concert, and that was with that was the Michael Brecker tribute concert that Susan put together a couple years ago, and there are a variety of guests on that, and Chaka was one, and I got to play Mike's chair essentially in the band and play some of the solos on those tunes, and it was a blast. I remember on the gig she had a fan in her rider to blow her hair around, you know, and the fan was not on when she came out on the stage, and so she refused to start playing until one of the people came from off stage and turned the fan on, which I loved. I mean, it was like this.
So what are some other saxophone players besides Coltrane and Brecker mm-hmm. that have really impacted you as a player and as a fan?
There are so many, because even if someone hasn't directly impacted me, they've impacted me by me choosing to do the opposite of it, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. Like someone like Mark Turner, for example, I really don't sound anything like Mark Turner, but that concept has been so influential in the last 15 years or so as a tenor player, you kind of can't not be influenced by that.
Yeah.
But in terms of people that are directly influential, I mean, you know, Michael, obviously, Jan Garbarek, Chris Cheek, in a way, on the concept of tone and the way I'm trying to utilize the saxophone, Ben Wendell in a certain way, Donnie McCaslin, of course, Chris Potter, in terms of just creative flow and improvisation. And then, you know, conceptually, there are people that I haven't checked out as much, but I find that the little I did impacted me a lot. Like someone like Steve Grossman, in a way, like that kind of way of playing just makes a lot of sense to me. And I took something from just sort of being exposed to that over time.
Yeah, it's very funny you mentioned Jan Garbarek, because I've been listening to him a lot over the past couple of days, you know, he started with much freer playing like Afric Pepperbird and Sart and albums like that. And then you get to something like 12 Moons. And it's just like the difference in the conception. Of course, his work with the Jarrett European Quartet as well.
Some of my favorite work is, of course, with Keith Jarrett, but also an album called Arbor Zena.
Yeah.
And Jan, he sounds so incredible on that. I spent a summer once just trying to emulate his tone on that record.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I was thinking to myself last night, there is a little bit of a Jan Garbarek thing in your sound as well.
Yeah.
That's that soulfulness. And also, since we were talking about Brecker for a lot of this interview so far, one of his biggest influences that I don't know if a lot of people realize, but Lenny White was talking about this when he was talking to David Schroeder, Stanley Turrentine.
Of course.
And I hear so much Stanley in Mike's playing.
Of course. Yeah, of course. That's one of the places where I start to see a generational divide, because I think for people like Mike, that it was so natural to assimilate that kind of vocabulary. I feel like for my generation, it's not so much. My background is inherently a lot more abstract, and I'm constantly trying to find ways to make things less abstract in a way.
How do you get young students then to check out the rich history of jazz? Because I've noticed with the education system, just from an outsider looking in, to me, as a jazz fan my entire life, it seems like a lot of the system is kind of homogenized.
In what sense?
There's like a focus on, okay, you check out these players.
Yeah.
And then people end up sounding like
very
a
derivative.
Certain group of players rather than the entire history. Let's say Lester Young or Chu Berry or, you know, people like
of
that.
Of course, and more contemporary things. I think that jazz education really focuses pretty much from about 1940 to 1965. You know, there's a very, at least that was my experience in studying it at Juilliard. I think maybe other programs might have more of a contemporary bent, but it sure seems like a lot of people get into that and then kind of stay there. It also is, I mean, it's such the rich part of jazz history. There's so much to do there, but there's a lot of more breadth to be found.
Oh yeah, and there's just as much happening now as there was back then. There are some people, I remember there was an article about Blue Note Records recently and talking about the Blue Note legacy, and it's mm-hmm. it's definitely probably my all-time favorite label, mm-hmm. and ECM is behind that. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. somebody was saying, you know, where is the next new thing? And I've had conversations, debates with a friend of mine, and he's like, there's really not the next Herbie Hancock, there's not the next Wayne Shorter, there's not the next, but
in part because I think it's so diffuse now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that jazz had a fairly linear history up until maybe right. 10 or 15 years ago. I think
exactly.
that innovations were sort of inevitable, and people the people that became known for those innovations were sort of the best at them. But there was sort of a general trajectory that everyone was on, if that makes sense. And now mm-hmm. I think we're at a point where we're in post-modernism or whatever it is, and everything is so diffuse
mm.
that there isn't really a center, you know?
Right. And there's all these hip things going on now, what I like to call micro-innovations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Antonio's band, Migration, that's right on the cusp of those micro-innovations.
Exactly. And I'd be curious to hear what you consider those micro-innovations to be. I definitely have my own take on
sure.
his work in that.
Well, for me, and I'd love to ask you too, how the music evolves night after night, mm-hmm, especially mm-hmm. when it's very composed, the improvisational
Correct.
Sections, how they differ from night to night. But mm-hmm. those micro-innovations, I feel, are... rhythmically, there's a particular school which Antonio is drawing upon also
Absolutely.
That is
yeah.
Informed by Chris Dave, Mark Juliana, mm-hmm. Mark Kohlenberg, those guys.
Mm-hmm. Nate Wood,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yes, and Antonio definitely defines the rhythmic vocabulary of that band. I sort of realized that on this last tour that we have all been sort of slowly developing a improvisational vocabulary over time by virtue of the way he has kind of inspired us to play,
mm-hmm.
you know. I also think that in his innovation, one of the most remarkable things is he's kind of a jazz rock symphonist.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? And there's really no one else doing that. And
right.
he writes, they're basically chamber pieces for mm-hmm. this sort of electro acoustic jazz rock context. I think and hope that will be a part of his legacy.
Yeah, and I would say that there is a certain harmonic thing to the way chords are used in modern jazz. To me, goes back to, say, after the 60s, like the way you hear changes in like Sting's music
mm-hmm,
or
absolutely.
Some Phil Collins pieces. That's, you know, Pat Metheny, obviously.
Of course.
There's all these things that inform that. Mm-hmm. And there's a particular use of changes that didn't happen until after the 60s when mm-hmm. jazz had absorbed pop and rock. And I'm going to say something very controversial here. I contend that jazz doesn't have to swing. There are so many debates.
Well, it depends on how you want to define it, because I feel similar. I think that there's two different things we're talking about here. One is the style of jazz, and mm-hmm. then the other is the process of jazz, okay?
Right.
After 1960 or so, jazz became a process. Before 1960, jazz was a style, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And really, it was Miles and Train, especially Miles, that just really opened it up at that point to becoming a process of how do we create music together on the spot? How do we, you know, create a compelling story using all these elements that we have built up to this point?
Right, because especially when you look at the second great quintet and then the lost quintet after that, the bands afterwards, you look at Weather Report, mm-hmm. you look at Headhunters,
right.
you look at Return of the Forever, you look at Mahavishnu,
mm-hmm.
you look at the Pat Metheny group, those are all, in my mind, those are evidence of the process that you're discussing.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think there's so much incredible music that gets sort of lost by a rigid definition of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very grateful for my education, but it was a somewhat rigid education. And,
right.
you know, one of the things that I'm kind of really getting into now is Alan Holdsworth's music,
mm.
which I never even really checked out until very recently, in part because there was sort of this stigma about it being this sort of fusion thing that wasn't really it, you know? And now I'm getting into it. I'm like, this is amazing. Like, in my opinion, he'll be remembered as on the level of like a Lenny Tristano of his time, or someone that was like incredibly virtuosic and innovative, but kind of off the radar, you know?
Exactly. And I feel also very strongly that there's a lot of music from the 80s era. Like, for example, I've gone back to listen to the Electric Band music. And I kind of avoided that for years because people used to always make fun of it. There was somebody who called it smooth jazz for particle physicists. And it's not that all. Okay, so yeah, some of the synth sounds are dated, but when you listen to actually what's going on,
it's amazing.
It's great stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, the same stigma has been said for Pat Metheny's music. And actually, since the dissolution of the Pat Metheny group, I feel that Antonio's band has taken that title. You know, that is, to me, that is the new Pat Metheny group.
Well, I'm honored to hear you say that. It's, yeah, I mean, definitely the aesthetic is inspired by that. I think in everyone's part, I mean, like my iwi playing in the group, I program for the iwi. You know, I design my own sounds.
Wow. And Lyle Mays did for.
Of course. Yeah. And there's a lot on there, but there's one that I end up consistently using that sounds kind of like Pat's GR300 sound.
Yes, you know? I noticed that. Yeah.
And part of it's just such a compelling sound, and it's just so fun to use in that context, you know.
The GR300 are the source of my favorite solos
of
his.
It's amazing.
And then
so great.
John Abercrombie had a great sound on the GR300 too.
Yes.
It's a shame that he stopped using it because he was coming up with something completely different.
Totally. There's a record, Peter Erskine record called Hero with a Thousand Faces. Have you heard this?
No, I haven't.
Check. Or no, I'm sorry. The record is called Motion Poet, and there's a track on there called Hero with a Thousand Faces, and Abercrombie plays a synth guitar solo, and then Brecker finishes the tune, and they're both some of the best solos I've ever heard from either of those guys.
His album Night is like some of the best Brecker I've ever heard.
I agree.
And you know, before we wrap this up, is there anything that you would like to talk about in terms of your own gigs coming up and where people can find you?
You know, unfortunately, there's not anything coming up of my own in the near future in New York. But I will be out west next week, actually, with my own band. We're playing at the Blue Whale in Los Angeles, the 1905 in Portland, Oregon, and McMenamin's in Bend, Oregon. That's going to be a lot of fun. Actually, the band is Nir Felder, who was the guitarist on this record. And then John Eskreet is going to play the piano chair. Dan Chmielinski, who was on the record, will be playing bass. And then Steve Lyman is going to join us. And we're doing some music off this record, some music off of Cross Current, and also some stuff that hasn't been recorded yet. Some music I've been working on with Steve that's very synth heavy, that's kind of influenced by Aphex Twin and some other stuff.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun.
That's another thing that I like too, because the thing with synthesizers, like when I was a kid, I grew up listening to everything, but for whatever reason, jazz and classical were the two musics that caught my attention. And I went whole hog into jazz. And then in the past 6 months or so, I've been getting back into my classical roots.
Sure.
And I always liked things with electric instruments, but then there were people when I was younger saying, well, you shouldn't like that because that's garbage. But I've always liked, you know, the synthesizer stuff.
Of course, and times have really kind of come around to that, especially there's so much interest in analog synthesizers. And in terms of the circles I run in, people basically kind of consider it a real instrument. I mean, it's not really as put upon as it was maybe 10 years ago even, you know.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Chase, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Really a lot of fun.
And everyone, if you are interested in learning more about the concepts that Chase Baird has talked about in this interview, you can check out some of the workshops at the New York Jazz Workshop, taught by Mark Sherman, which is from bebop to hard bop, and also Modern Jazz Ensemble, which is another course by Sebastian Noel that can shed light on a lot of these movements that are happening. So, for the New York Jazz Workshop in Conversation With podcast series, I'm CJ Shern. Peace, love, groove, and keep swinging, everybody.